Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
So we have two huge live games on Off the Ball this Sunday. We're on air all the way through till 7 o'clock because it's a 4:30 start for the Manchester Derby. City against United. It's going to be live with Dave McIntyre and Stephen Reid. Before that, I'll be at Stamford Bridge alongside Stephen Kelly at 2:15 kickoff for Chelsea against Everton to look ahead to the games and maybe bring us some of the highlights of the Keith Andrews show. It is Keith Andrews.
Hello,
see what
pal.
I did there. How are you?
Very good. Very good. They're two good games, aren't they?
They are two good games. Yeah. They're not the Sheffield Derby, the Steel City Derby.
It's tomorrow. That is tomorrow. That'll be a good one, that.
You got the call up,
really
did you?
Good one. That'll be a good one. I'm on commentary, actually, which is unusual because Andy Hinchcliffe normally does commentary on a Friday night. I'm normally studio, but looking forward to it. Really looking forward to it.
So, Sheffield United are flying at the moment.
Sheffield
Chris Wilder is their manager.
Yeah, born and bred Sheffield United fan.
Okay.
Stood on the terraces, play in a manner where you would expect the fan to be in charge, not belittling them. They play really exciting front foot football, aggressive, in your face, but play good stuff. He's evolved the way they've played. They've made some good signings. John Egan being a prime example that in the summer. He's made a big difference. The heart of defence, play a 3-5-2 system where the three at the back, the ones on the side, actually overlap the wing backs at times.
Right.
That adventurous, that forward thinking.
Are they the Wolves of this season?
No, I wouldn't.
That level of quality?
No, not that level of quality, but in terms of where they are financially, they're batting above where they should be. They don't pay big money. They have made good signings in the summer. Norwood, who plays for Northern Ireland, and Egan, been two really good signings.
They're traditionally, obviously, a big club.
Yeah, both of them are.
They've been in the Premier League. But for Sheffield United, if this run continues, if they were to earn promotion, is there the money behind Sheffield United that they could go and stay in the Premier League?
There's a bit of a battle going on at the moment between joint owners. Percentage-wise, one of them wants to buy out the more traditional owner. I think his name is McCabe. So he's looking to buy him out, wants to invest more. McCabe is more of a traditional, wants to do things slowly. So that has to get sorted out. But in terms of the fan base and the side, both of the clubs, you would have to suggest, but Sheffield United, obviously more likely. Sheffield Wednesday had their opportunity in the last couple of years. They have really speculated and it's kind of come down crashing. The manager struggling, four losses in a row. I think they've conceded 12 in the last four defensively, all over the place against a team that in Sheffield United, playing at Sheffield United tomorrow, no home team has scored more goals, so it's going to be tough for them.
Yeah, so we'll keep an eye out.
Keep tuned in.
We certainly will. So the Manchester derby is the biggest derby of the weekend. Where do you lie with United over the past month or so? Is this a squad that's sort of raging against the dying of the light and are just finding a bit of character for 10-15 minute spurts? Or do you actually look at them and think, yeah, there is a lot of character in this side now. They're learning, they're growing as a group, and they can put together a decent run of form, that there's signs that it's all coming together?
Well, if I got back a month ago, I thought we were coming to the end of Jose's reign. I really did. So there has been huge promise in that last month. Some of the performances, the late comebacks, the little glimpses of 10, 15, 20 minute spells that you've alluded to. I think we have seen that, and we have seen shows.
Is that enough though? Because say look at the past week, or even the past couple of weeks, the Bournemouth performance. Bournemouth killed them
in the first half an hour
in particular. Could have easily been 3 or 4 nil up. Maybe it's still the weight of the Manchester United name that's playing on the strikers' minds when they're in a game like that. But huge missed opportunities.
Yeah, I think the last month, when you look at the last month, again, it's been the glimpses. I just think overall it hasn't been enough. And I think when you look at the last month, some of those performances that have been good, the comeback against Juventus last night, magnificent comeback, and bringing on Fellaini, it's plan B again. I still think they should be further down the line. But having said that, if you're judging it on the last month, there's been really encouraging signs. Now, has that been Jose giving them a little bit more freedom, a little bit more love? Or has it been players going, do you know what, this is getting a little bit embarrassing. You know, we're constantly getting criticised. Our performance, it's taking its toll. So is it player-driven? Is it Jose? I'm not sure. Really not sure what way it's come from. Is Michael Carrick had more of a say, finding his feet as a number two? Very, very hard to put your finger on it. But it has certainly been better in the last month, hasn't it?
Yeah, because that question's always asked when teams suddenly produce performances, not even for a full game. You always think back to the night in Paris and Thierry Henry's handball. The question was always asked, you know, was this Trapattoni finally getting his tactics spot on, or was it a player-led revolt almost that actually we have nothing left to lose at this stage, we're going to do things our way? Like, do you find that out over time now at United as to whether Mourinho's having an impact? Like, if it doesn't last, does that suggest actually it's just a player-led thing?
Yeah, exactly. It won't last if it's just player-led, because that can't continue. They're normally, you know, isolated performances, aren't they, where you get that type of level and goes against the grain of what we've become accustomed to seeing. And what we've become accustomed to seeing from Jose, we were chatting about this yesterday actually with a mate of mine. I don't know what a Jose Mourinho Man United side is. When you look at Sarri already a few months into his Chelsea tenure, you know what a Sarri team looks like. You know what Manchester City look like. I don't know what Manchester City, or sorry, what Manchester United are. And even in terms of the front three, are they his Chelsea team where it's Robin and Duff, wide, high? Do they rely on that width? Are they narrow forwards? Do they play with two strikers, and two in midfield and one ahead? I don't know, and I don't think he knows. And I think we're all in agreement he doesn't know his best 11, certainly.
You talk about, and we all, I think, loved that Chelsea team of the time of Drogba and Robin and Duff, and maybe it was because Duff was such an integral part of it, but they were also so devastating on the counter-attack. Yeah. So brilliant at the back, defensively solid, but just utterly devastating when Robin and Duff had the peak of their powers. Yeah. Why has he not returned to that when you look at what is there at United? Is it that Romelu Lukaku is nowhere near the quality of Didier Drogba,
so
therefore you can't get Rashford and Martial into the way Drogba could get?
Well, if you look at that Chelsea team,
Robin,
I think attacking-wise, he has relatively similar players with traits that were Duff, pace, power out wide, and the likes of Robin compared to, say, Martial, Lukaku to Drogba, not a million miles off. Defensively, totally different. Now, we go back to the summer and he kept on chipping away about the players not coming in, the board not backing him. What does that do to the players' confidence? They, at the start of the season, certainly, they look like they were on eggshells. They really do. And in terms of the whole team, that consistency, it hasn't been there. That Chelsea team was so consistent in its selection and the way they played, whereas this Man United team is so vastly different.
From all your work on Virgin Media Sport over the past couple of months, watching Champions League, Europa League, Nations League, have you seen a centre-back out there that United should be chasing down in January if this 100 million comes available?
I tell you what, they dodged a couple of bullets, in my opinion, in the summer.
Harry Maguire?
Boateng, without a shadow of a doubt. I think Harry Maguire would have been just reactionary to the way the World Cup went. One of the best English players, let's get him in. Where, like, realistically, if you're doing your due diligence, you should be scouting players, have them earmarked before World Cups, get them for less of a premium, get them in. But I think they need a dominant force. We only have to look across the way in Liverpool, what Van Dijk has done to that defence of Liverpool. But I think there's plenty he could choose.
Milan Skriniar.
Skriniar from Inter Milan, do you like him?
Again, maybe he's not that character you're looking for. Yeah, he's a proper ball
he's a
player,
good
he's still
defender.
Very young. I think they still need that big totemic
leadership figure. Of all the ones that were mentioned in the summer, would have been my preference. And I think he's gone flat at Spurs last season, didn't play much. He would have been my preference to go into that heart of the defence. I think Boateng, absolutely not. No way, I wouldn't have gone near him with a barge ball. I think he's carrying about a stone and a half. The wages and what it would have cost would have been astronomical. But I like Skriniar, I'm with you, but maybe alongside another one, but then you're talking to, which I'm sure Jose would be happy with.
Yeah. Where do you stand on where Marcus Rashford is right now in his career? Because he's been talked up and has delivered at times, and he's still very young. He's still only just gone 21 in the last week or so. But he scored, what, 5 Premier League goals in the last 12 months? For a guy who's touted as the next Michael Owen, as the most obvious comparison, he hasn't quite got there yet. Is he all that? Is he just not been used right?
Oh yeah, I think he is all that, Nathan. I really do. And I think you've only got to look to the way he was utilised with England in that Spanish game. In a wider area, no problem. Eventually he will be a top centre forward as long as he gets the development.
Is now not the time you'd want him as a centre forward though, when he's young and he's got all of his pace?
I don't think he's solely reliant on pace. When you look at Michael Owen, I know he spoke about it even to Joe, hasn't he, in the last couple of months about the book and the way he had to change his game. I think Rashford is quite intelligent already in the way he can operate, the positions he picks up. I don't think he's solely reliant on pace. I haven't got a big issue where he plays along that front three. I really don't, because I think he can be devastating in any three of those positions. And I think for the time being, it probably suits him a little bit more playing from the wing. And he also gives you the work rate going the other way and a counter and second slow, which we've seen in Spain for England. Has he hit at the heights where he might have under a different manager with a little bit more freedom? No, I think that's probably fair to say, but I still think it's very, very early days. Jose always goes back to look at the minutes he's played. He's still developing. He's still... Look, that is true. He has got a lot of minutes for the age he is, but I think most of us would think, well, why is he not doing it that little bit more? And I think there's a few factors involved in that, positionally, the managerial, the style, and his age, obviously.
The last Manchester derby was, well, quite like a lot of Manchester United games over the past month, where they found themselves 2-0 down at half-time, turned it around completely in the second half, delayed City winning the title, and there was a bit of character that day. Like, there is a concern, not just with this game, but with the entire season, that for all Liverpool have done to improve, and Chelsea coming together quickly than anyone expected under Sarri, that maybe Manchester City are just that good.
They are, don't
they? Do you think they're going to win this league by double figures?
Didn't at the start of the season. De Bruyne had been out and not particularly missing him when he was out, because Bernardo Silva was playing really well in a central position. I just think they're so slick, and you're right, we've spoken about Liverpool's improving. Chelsea have probably surprised nearly everybody with how well they've settled and done. But Manchester City are just so slick in the way they go about things.
Are there any major changes from last season?
In terms of the way they're playing, no. I just think when you look around the team, you're seeing players that are constantly improving. Sterling being a prime example. I think Sané will go again on a patch during this season, go on to another level. Bernardo Silva is better than he was last year. He looks fitter, sharper, stronger, and he looks more settled in that side. David Silva is just David Silva. And I think Aguero's probably looked the sharpest he's looked in a few years, maybe. Get Jesus scoring during the week will do his confidence the world of good. He got a hat-trick. So they've just stepped it up. Liverpool have, to a degree, in the last few weeks, maybe stepped off it a little bit.
Well, any other season, Liverpool's points total would have them top of the league right now.
But that's what Manchester City are. I think we're very fortunate to be witnessing this. Mm. Everyone will point, obviously, to spending. But the coaching that those players are getting, you were talking about Marcus Rashford. Well, look at the difference in Raheem Sterling. The same can be said about Martial. The promise is there. Like, go back 2 years ago. Who would you rather have, Martial or Raheem Sterling?
Oh.
You know, that's where it is, and that's the difference. And it's not just managers and coaches. It's obviously comes down to the individual. How much are they buying into improving themselves on a daily basis? The prime example of that over the last 10 to 15 years has been Ronaldo. Look what he's still producing last night against Manchester United, that goal. Devotion to his trade. And whether that's happening with certain players, we obviously don't know.
So that is the Manchester derby. It's a 4:30 start. Dave McIntyre will be alongside Stephen Reid for that. First up, though, we'll have Chelsea against Everton, which I'm looking forward to. I've seen quite a bit of Everton over the past 5-6 weeks. And first off, I saw them being beaten at Arsenal, and it just felt like it was the same old Everton, where there was no great consistency. Mm. The front four had nice touches here and there without ever really influencing the game. But the last 3 weeks, they've had Andre Gomez finally fit on loan from Barcelona. He's just run the show in the middle of midfield, because they have the energy and the enthusiasm of Idrissa Gueye, who'll always get himself about. But now, rather than him having to find one of the front four, he just gives it to Gomez, who just strolls around the middle of the park, just calm in possession, able to pick out the right pass. And it feels as though it has changed maybe what Everton can achieve this season. Now, this, though, is a pretty tough test going.
Yeah, it will be a tough test, because Sarri's been producing really high standard football in a relatively short space of time. But I agree about Everton. I think Gomez has made a difference. You were doing the highlights to me. I didn't see that game you were at a few weeks ago, and I watched the next one on the box, and I thought he was a class apart in the centre of the park, and a step up class wise of what they have had in there, the
likes of Schneiderlin.
Yeah. So he, and do you know what else as well? The robust side of the game didn't seem a problem for him. He was having that as well, which you always worry about when they come from a different league on the continent. So I think the chemistry between those two, Idrissa Gueye and Gomez, looks good, looks nice. I'm still not sure about exactly what way that front four is working with Richarlison as the striker. I know he got his goal, really good goal last weekend. Still worries me a little bit. And the consistency of Theo Walcott as well.
it would frustrate the life out
of him. Yeah, I agree. And it shouldn't be that case, the age he's at.
And of that front four, actually, he's probably been the poorest so far this season.
Yeah, I agree.
Been very few real positive moments from where Sigurdsson, again, struggles with a little bit of inconsistency, but generally seems to be up in his game a little bit. Seamus Coleman is obviously back, fully fit, is back in the Ireland squad as well. Seems to have been a change in Coleman's outlook and character over the past month or so. Like, you know him, you've been on the receiving end of it in the last month, but he's done a lot of post-match interviews. He's come out as the Everton captain. We saw the celebration last week, which would have sort of feels like it was out of character, having a real go at his own supporters who've been at his back. Because whenever we talk about Coleman, automatically we say, brilliant right back, one of the best in the league. And you'll always get texts in straight away from Everton fans going, you're clearly not watching him week in, week out, because he's not at the level he was before he got the injury. I'm just wondering now that, like, and 30 is at that stage of his career that maybe he's just decided, screw it.
Yeah, I'm going to have my say, which crack on and do it. I was really surprised though with the celebration. I have to say, when I first seen it back, I was like, wow, just so unlike Seamus, because he has been the blue-eyed boy and quite rightly so as well. The way he goes about his business and the level he has produced year on year at Everton, he's been one of, or if not the most consistent performer at Goodison Park. But maybe since the injury, after the whole euphoria of that getting back and then maybe it's tailed off, maybe he hasn't hit the heights. But and then what you will also find as well, with players that have been there a long time, there's a little bit of grace period with new players coming in, and maybe they're thinking, well, oh, we have to give Bernard time, we have to give Walker, we have to give Richarlison time if they're not having that off game. But the solid citizen of Seamus Coleman, and maybe the level that he hit before the injury, maybe he hasn't got back to that level.
Yeah,
I don't think his performances have been poor in any way, shape or form.
We probably shouldn't underestimate as well, and we look forward to the day where we get to properly sit down with him for an hour and talk about the injury and the effect that had on him with that year out, because I've always felt it was this career-altering injury, because that was the summer where he could have gone. That was the summer where he might have got his one big move that's probably passed him by at this stage. Everton is where he's going to be more than likely, you'd imagine, for the rest of his career. And what's that done to him mentally, and having had a lot of time off to think about his role with Ireland, his role with Everton, and maybe just being a leader and what that takes, and no longer just sitting and being quiet post-match. That actually, like the interview that I did with him where he was on about the Ireland and the punditry and the criticism and that, it was interesting how he always was having a pop at his own teammates as well about managers at Everton are the ones who always give up their job. When I look in that dressing room, I see a lot of guys who haven't pulled their weight over the last
while. Maybe it's built up over that period of time, and you do get time for reflection when you have a long time out with injury. And it's for so long he's been that quiet figure, and even when he gets the armband, he gets it off John O'Shea at international level, Phil Jagielka at club level. He is the captain of club and country now, and quiet along the way. Maybe now he's feeling things aren't quite sitting so well with me, and I am going to say it and look, crack on and say it. And I was really surprised to see him to the Gladys Street though, because he's had such an affinity and such a really good.
Well, part of that may well be as well, listen, I'm sure he's had offers to go.
What I would
say,
he's
always made it clear he loves Everton, and I've stuck with this club through all the nonsense that's gone on, and now you're having a pop at me.
But on the flip side of that, Everton came out quite quickly after that
injury. A new contract.
Yeah, so they actually, I thought they'd done a really good thing at the time when he probably needed and was feeling really, really low.
Well, I'm hoping to interview Seamus after the game on Sunday. So if there's anything you'd like to get off your chest right now, just so I can throw it to him.
I have enough of a platform.
Wait, and I'll tell you what Keith Andrews just said about you, Seamus. It was all positive. All right, good stuff as always, Keith.
Cheers, pal.
Keith Andrews Show, live on all our social channels every Thursday lunchtime. Yeah, so that was Keith Andrews, who was in a bit earlier, presenting that lunchtime show, which is up on offtheball.com right now. This week, he had an interview with the former Ireland international, Stephen Reid. So that is well worth checking out. They talk about his coaching career. He has left Crystal Palace, how he has an interest in maybe getting involved with the Republic of Ireland under 21s. And Stephen is going to be part of our commentary team this coming Sunday for the Manchester Derby. He'll be alongside Dave McIntyre for the 4:30 kickoff. As we said, we also have Chelsea against Everton. Stephen Kelly will be with me for that. Gets underway at 2:15. Come on, lads, how many United players will get in the City team? Says Graham in Offaly.
15.
Realistically, would even David De Gea get in the City team now?
Does it matter? It's all about how the players you have at your disposal and how you manage them.
It's going to be a long show to fill, Richie, if everything, the answer is, does it matter?
The answer is no to
what
most
really
things.
Matters?
Nothing.
No mention, as usual, of City's back four. Laporte is as solid as Van Dijk.
That's absolute fact. Aymeric Laporte is one of the best signings of the past 12 months. I don't think there's any dispute about that.
No, he's definitely the first choice right now. Is he at the level of Big Virgil, though?
See, the thing about Laporte is, it's because he has no international recognition, because he's kind of betwixt and between things in terms of where he fits in. That
Am I French? Am I Spanish?
I don't think he's judged in the same way that other defenders are, which is a bit unfortunate, but he's definitely one of the best in the Premier League.
So Europa League is ongoing. Celtic midway through the second half against Red Bull Leipzig. They needed to win this.
Rasenball Sport Leipzig, for the purposes of non-sponsorship
deals. Oh, really?
That's what they're called in Europe at the moment. Yeah. But it is Celtic 1, Red Bull Leipzig 0.
What does Rasenball mean?
Something ball.
Good lad, Richie.
First year German. Kieran Tierney's strike in 11 minutes separates the sides at Parkhead at the moment. It would be a very much needed win for Celtic, would drag them level on points with second placed Rosenborg. They are losing at the moment 5-2 at home to Salzburg. So Group B is very much alive, even if top spot isn't at the moment. Elsewhere, Arsenal 0, Sporting 0 remains the score with about 25 minutes to go at the Emirates in Group E. As things stand, Arsenal would be heading through as Karabag. We're 1-0 up away to Vorskla. Appears to be some delay to that one, bringing an update on that. But the big news coming out of the Emirates tonight would be that Danny Welbeck has suffered what looked like a very, very serious ankle injury and was carted off, needing oxygen as well, on his way off the pitch. So a very serious injury for Danny Welbeck in that game this evening. The game involving Vorskla and Karabag has been interrupted, the referee calling a stop to that one. Fireworks were to blame. So it appears that that one, the referee has stopped the Vorskla Karabag game as a result of fireworks.
Richie,
in Ukraine. Yes.
Nobody cares. Nobody.
Right, fair enough. Rangers losing a classic away to Spartak Moscow. 4-3.
It's just the 90 seconds on Vorskla Karabag.
Dude, it's in Arsenal's group. It depends on whether has an impact on whether Arsenal go through or not.
Not that much of an impact. Bloody
hell. Rangers losing 4-3 away to Spartak Moscow. Elsewhere in the group, VRL top, albeit a very, very tight group. A scoreless draw for the La Liga side away to Rapid Vienna tonight. And Chelsea 1-0 winners away to Bate Borisov. A header from Olivier Giroud, giving them all 3 points and passage through to the last 32. They will be confirmed as group winners in Group L if they pick up a point at home to Pau Thessaloniki. That is in 3 weeks' time.
Yeah, first goal of the season for Olivier Giroud tonight. And speaking on Virgin Media Sport this evening, Kevin Coban has been saying that it should be a big weight off Giroud's shoulders.
Yeah, he's come back. He hasn't been a sharp after the World Cup. He played such a huge part for France in winning the World Cup over the summer. And he hasn't looked great. He hasn't. His link-up play in general is always very good. But he's not, even the games I've seen him, he's not necessarily been getting the chances. And tonight proved that again, as Mick suggested there. He wasn't necessarily getting any sort of real quality balls played into him. So, yes, that is what he needed. He's desperate to get a goal. And the movement was classic Giroud, exactly what we've seen of him over the years.
First goal in 794 minutes for Olivier Giroud. I hate that stat because it makes you do the maths. How many games is that, Richie?
It's just somebody trying to show off in terms of stats.
How many games is that?
Somebody sat there and worked out.
It's not quite 9 games.
Because the clock starts from the time of his last goal.
Exactly.
So he might score in like the 9th minute of a game. And it's like 81. Does that include stoppage time?
You see, these are the questions. Like, I love my stats, but that stat is nonsensical. Like, maybe saying he hasn't scored in his last 17 appearances, even that is a little bit, well, was one of them coming off for 28 seconds at the end of a match when they were 4-0 up.
So you're saying you're not happy with either way of measuring the distance between goals?
It is his first goal of the season, though, which is the only thing.
Do you know what? He's a handyman to have around. He's one of those, he's a squad player who doesn't seem to get the camel about it. So if he's going to be on the bench for a couple of games running, it's not as if he's going to be moody about it when he comes off. He's going to come on.
How could you be moody when you're that good looking?
That's true. That probably plays a factor in things.
Life is just so much better.
He's living in London. He's on
World Cup winner
a week. He's a handsome divil.
Does anybody have it better than Olivier Giroud?
Who gives a monkey's whether he scores in 738 minutes? Doesn't matter. You're handsome. You're fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's an extra spur to Alvaro Morata as well, just to keep him honest, I suppose.
Yeah, so Chelsea Everton live this Sunday. Remember, Virgin Media Sport is the new home of European football in Ireland, with more than 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. Virgin Media Sport is exclusive to all Virgin Media TV customers, who can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream all the action whenever and wherever they like. You want to come back in, but if it's another bloody update, Arashlau and Carabag.
Somebody says, sorry, but some people are interested in the Vorskil game. I'm waiting on them to score for 100 quid.
We'll take a quick break.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
You're welcome back to Thursday's football show. So this Saturday sees the first leg of the Copa Libertadores final. For the first time ever, it is a Super Classico in the final. Boca Juniors against River Plate at La Bombonera, and Tim Vickery is on the line from Brazil to look forward to it. Evening, Tim.
Good evening, how are you doing?
Would I be exaggerating things to say this is the biggest game in the history of Argentinian club football?
No. Not at all. It is the biggest, and it's almost too big, you know. And it's absolutely huge. And the tickets are exchanging, you know, on the black market, are going for the price of a house, more or less. And whoever loses is never, ever going to hear the end of this. Never. I mean, in 50 years' time, they will still be laughed at and mocked in the streets because they lost the biggest clash in one of the biggest rivalries that there is in world football.
Two great names of world football. It's surprising that it's the first time they've ever met in the Copa Libertadores decider, and also that they've met so few times in the competition at all.
Yeah, I mean, for most of the history of the Libertadores, you couldn't have a final between clubs from the same country. It was kind of filtered through, so you had to meet in the earlier rounds. We had a couple of all-Brazil finals just over a decade ago. This is not only the first Boca River, it's the first all-Argentine final. And it's just a huge, huge occasion. It's changing everything. And usually the finals are Wednesday night. This time, with security considerations, both because of security of the game and because the original date for the second leg would pretty much coincide with a meeting of the G20, Donald Trump and all, in Buenos Aires. For security reasons, both games have been moved to Saturday afternoon Argentina time, which I think is 8 p.m. Island time, which means that there's going to be an opportunity for more people all around the world, and especially I think in Europe because of the time difference, to follow what goes on. I would say it's one of those games like the old Doctor Who of my childhood. You might want to watch it behind the settee now and again. a mate of mine, fanatic for Argentine football, has just flown down today. He'll be at both games, and he said to me, "I'm not expecting games. You know, the games aren't going to be very good, but the atmosphere is going to be phenomenal." I think that at the moment, that's a kind of general consensus, that the tension is just going to be so great that it's, and I think especially the first leg, it's going to be tense, it's going to be tight. No one is going to want to make a mistake. So I think we can guarantee drama, we can certainly guarantee atmosphere. Whether we can guarantee quality, I think, is another matter.
That atmosphere, though, it's going to be pretty one-sided. There's not going to be any away fans at either game?
That's right, which is standard practice in Argentine football.
But there was talk that they might have actually changed it for this match initially.
But in the end, I think security considerations won out. So, and also the fact that for the home side, it means you can sell more tickets because you don't have to have any separation between the two fans. It means that, and one of the beauties of this game is that they are so different in a way, that both of these clubs grew up in the working class Docklands area of Buenos Aires. Boca Juniors have defiantly stayed put. River Plate have long since moved out to the snooty suburbs. So you get completely different atmospheres. On Boca, the area is called La Boca. It's colourful, shall we say, full of character, which may be a euphemism for not entirely safe all of the time. You know, it's cramped and it's claustrophobic. There's not a lot of space. You walk quickly, you avoid eye contact. You can see there's no space from the football stadium. It's called La Bombonera, the chocolate box, for a reason. It just goes straight up, not for vertigo sufferers. And it means that those fans are close to the pitch and the atmosphere is extraordinary. River Plate, where we'll have the second leg in 3 weeks' time, is a different proposition, or just over 2 weeks' time, is a different proposition. River Plate, that they moved out to the suburbs, wide, leafy avenues. It's a huge bowl-like stadium. Some of the corridors are so wide in there, you could be in the United Nations building. And so the atmosphere that their fans create is also very different. It's equally insane, but just different, you know, because architecture matters. So on the level of a symbol, if you like, Boca stand for the old traditional working class. You can also almost see the army of Perón. You know, it's Perón's army jumping up and down there, whereas River Plate, they call themselves the millionaires, and that they have a reputation for being a little bit more cerebral with their fans. If you actually look at the sociological surveys, there's almost no difference between Boca fans and River fans. But on the level of the symbol, it's very, very important, the separate identities that these clubs have.
So they won't get to meet inside the stadium, the two sets of supporters, but just how tense will it be around Buenos Aires for these couple of weeks with this game and with this final being on? Is it a rivalry that does boil over on a fairly regular basis?
Yeah, it does. I think we've already had a fan death because of this. And it's a national event because these are national teams with national support bases. You know, over half the population supports either Boca or River. So, yeah, I think already one death has been reported. And Argentine football has a serious problem with fan violence. And these huge derby games, they can generate much more heat than light. So, you know, hopefully at the end, we'll be talking about football and atmosphere and not a death count.
Yeah, and Tim, if they're not letting away supporters in general into matches in Argentina, where are the issues cropping up? Is it around the stadium the days of the games?
No, it's all over. Can be all over. Can be hundreds of miles away from the stadium. And as I said, these are clubs with national support bases. So you can have River and Boca fans clashing hundreds of miles away from Buenos Aires. It's one of those things where sometimes, you know, wearing the wrong shirt at the wrong time can prove to be a very unfortunate decision.
We get to see Argentinian players in the Premier League every week playing in the best leagues all over Europe. There seems to be a constant flow of talent to the top clubs in Europe from Argentina. Where does that leave the quality of Argentinian football right now?
Well, I think that there's an excellent illustration here. And you just had the big, it's not, to my mind, a derby game, but it is a rivalry game, Barcelona and Real Madrid. You know, we had that a couple of weeks ago. And all six goals were scored by South Americans. The youngest of those South Americans, the one who left South America latest was Arturo Vidal at the age of 20. All the others left as teenagers. Now, obviously, that means a hollowing out. There's no doubt about that. And the quality on this side of the Atlantic suffers as a consequence. In this particular year, both River and Boca have invested heavily. They've got deep squads. It may not be sustainable. And since then, during the course of the year, the Argentine currency has collapsed. And because a lot of the contracts are in dollar, that's a problem. So there could well be a fire sale at the end of the year. I could certainly see some European clubs swooping on some of the younger talent that we got available on both sides. But for the time being, anyway, for these 2 weeks, there is quality on both sides. Whether the occasion will be too tense for it to rise to the surface, we'll have to see. There's no away goals rule in operation in the final. Away goals rule is in operation in the previous rounds, not in the final. And that's another thing that could contribute to make the first game a little bit more tense, because there's no real onus on River Plate to go and get the away goal.
Their routes to the final then, River Plate beat the defending champions Grêmio in the semi-final. Pretty controversial circumstances.
Very much so, yes. With VAR and with a late VAR penalty, which in the end, even Grêmio accepted that it was a penalty, but it does show you how VAR changes the game. It was a shot deflected behind for a corner. Even River weren't appealing for a penalty, but then the VAR referee had spotted it. It was clearly blocked with an outstretched arm. I think one perhaps lesson here for world football is, with VAR in operation, defending very deep now carries extra risks. Because, you know, other things are going to be spotted.
Accidents can happen.
Grêmio were very unhappy with the first River Plate goal on that in that game, which was a header glanced in from a free kick. It seems, looking at it 300 times on video replays, it may have glanced off his arm as well. So they're saying, well, VAR worked against us, but it didn't work for us. I tend to the view that some of the people who've been pushing VAR have oversold it and sold the idea it was going to be a panacea and it was going to eliminate all possible problems. We've already seen that's not going to be that's not going to be the case. So River Plate kind of snuck into the final. That they were eliminated with 10 minutes to go and managed to pull that one round. Boca Juniors got in there more easily on aggregate against Palmeiras of Brazil. But if you look at the records going into this final, exactly the same. 6 wins, 5 draws, 1 defeat, which tells you there ain't no favourites in this one. There wouldn't be anyway, you know, because previous form goes out the window. The last time these two sides met was in a league game at Boca's ground 2 months ago, 23rd of September. And River won that one 2-0. However, I don't think Boca fielded a particularly good team on that occasion. I think it may well have been the last hurrah for Carlos Tevez, who started that game, hasn't been seen since in the Libertadores, hasn't even come off the bench. He may well have a role to play. He's a big occasion play. He may well have a role to play in these two matches, but it's not going to be as a starter, I think. If he does get a run, it's going to be off the bench. And Boca have tweaked their side since then. So they will argue that 2-0 defeat on home ground less than 2 months ago was an accident, which isn't going to be repeated on Saturday.
How has Tevez taken his relegation to a bench role?
Well, it seems fair enough. I mean, he came back from a very, very unsuccessful spell in China, came back at the start of this year, and he really hasn't done it this year. He's lost his pace. And in the group stage of the Libertadores, Boca struggled a little bit, and they looked like a side where his presence was a hindrance. It was looked to those one of those sides, you know, one of those sides kind of built around a star when the star isn't performing anymore. So he seems to have taken it well enough. And as I say, that they've got quite a deep squad, and the fellow who's really fired into form up front is the centre forward Benedetto, who may well have been Argentina's World Cup centre forward, but he suffered a long term injury towards the end of last year. Came back kind of August, really looked off the pace, wasn't playing well. And then in the semi-final, coming off the bench in both games, he just found his mojo again, and he was banging in fantastic goals. So that's a selection decision. Do you start with him on Saturday, or do you leave him on the bench and bring him on the second half? But if he is on the bench, as he has been, he clearly gets on before Tevez does.
And quality-wise then, from River Plate, who are we looking out for?
Well, I'm not sure he's going to get a start, but the main creative force is the fellow who had such a great World Cup for Colombia, Juan Fernando Quintero, the left-footed playmaker. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he doesn't start, if they leave him on the bench. But when he comes on, he's not the world's greatest athlete, and he doesn't tend to last 90 minutes. But when he comes on, suddenly football is generated. From the start, I think there's another young Colombian, Santos Borré, the striker, who moves very well behind the defensive line. He's opening up space for those coming from behind. And one of those coming from behind is a young teenage midfielder who's not going to be around very long. And some of the big giants from Europe are already interested in him. Ezequiel Palacios, who's strong, dynamic midfielder. And he'll be one of those players who'll be trying to take advantage of the space that Santos Borré opens up.
The winners of this head in then to the World Club yes. Championship. Like, is that in any way as relevant right now? Is
hugely
it all just bragging rights?
No, well, that's taken so seriously in South America, really seriously. Obviously, at the moment, it's overshadowed by who's going to win the Libertadores. But then you got your sights gunning on Real Madrid, you know, and why not? If you can conquer Buenos Aires, you know, today it's Buenos Aires, tomorrow the world. So that plays big. Although no one is thinking about that for the moment. I think the worrying thing is the extent to which no one wants to lose. I was reading this from an old mate of mine, Sergio Levinsky. He's a veteran Argentine journalist. He's a Boca fan. And he's already tweeting. He's saying, look, because the second leg's at River Stadium. So he's saying, look, we Boca, if we win, we get to do the lap of honour. Boca get to do the lap of honour in River's stadium. Now, that's the ultimate humiliation. And it's something that River will probably never have the chance to do, because from next year, we go to a one-off final on a neutral ground. So in order for River to have the chance to do a lap of honour at Boca's stadium, three things have to happen. Buenos Aires has to be chosen as the venue for the final. Boca Stadium then has to be chosen as the venue in Buenos Aires, and Boca and River have to qualify for the final again. So for the moment, the ball is on the penalty spot for Boca to do a lap of honour in front of none of their own fans at River Stadium. And if that happens, you know, light the touch paper and retire to a safe distance.
I was just going to say, you can imagine what the atmosphere will be like as they stroll around the pitch. Maybe they'd be better off keeping it quite short, that lap of honour, I would imagine. What's your prediction then, Tim?
I'll tell you afterwards. I really haven't got one. You know, always make your predictions after the event anyway, because they tend to be more accurate that way. But I really, really don't have one. Because the big untold factor here is the effect that pressure is going to have on these players. This pressure is going to be absolutely insane. How is that going to affect the players? Who is going to be affected most? Who is going to suffer? Who is going to rise to the occasion? Don't know. Tell you afterwards.
All right, Tim Vickery, great stuff. We're looking forward to it. Saturday evening, 8 o'clock, perfect time in this part of the world for Boca Juniors against River Plate. Celtic in the Europa League this evening have just gone 2-1 up against Leipzig. Leipzig equalised through Jean-Kevin Augustin, but within a minute, Edouard put Celtic back in front. A huge win in injury time there. If they can hold out Celtic, we'll bring you through the full times in just a couple of moments.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Celtic have beaten Leipzig 2-1 in the Europa League to keep their chances of qualification alive. Arsenal 0-0 with Sporting in injury time at the Emirates, but that should still be enough to see them through to the knockout stage with two games to spare. Tonight's mystery voice was Sean O'Gorhalpin.
I completely see it, man.
Congratulations to Dennis O'Sullivan from Cork, who's won a €100 gift card to maxsport.ie and is also in the end-of-week draw to bag a €1,000 gift card. You'll have another chance to win tomorrow night as well. It's all with thanks to maxsport.ie. Visit their showroom in the Sandyford Industrial Estate in Dublin or shop online at maxsport.ie. OTB AM live as ever from 7:45 a.m. tomorrow morning, where the lads will continue their build-up to the weekend sporting action. Tomorrow night, we've got Keith Wood, Malcolm O'Kelly and Dennis Leamy looking ahead to the game against Argentina. There'll also be Friday Night Racing with Johnny Ward and the trainer Tony Martin, and of course the crappy quiz as well. Tom Dunn is up next. Good night.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.